the human fabric, we as human brains all coming together, we're a neurodiverse group, and that's a wonderful thing.
This is Leaderful, where we give you the models and the frameworks, the strategies and the skills that you need to drive true transformation for yourself, your team, your organization, and the world. Welcome to the show. All right, welcome back to another episode of the Leaderful Podcast. Today, I am thrilled to introduce you to Dave Thompson. Dave's an educator, innovator, advocate in the field of neurodiversity employment. He's currently the Director of Strategic Programs for Potentia, where he supports companies in becoming more neuro-inclusive through training on best practices, as well as recruiting and providing ongoing support to neurodistinct professionals. Dave is also a TEDx speaker and just an all-around brilliant guy when it comes to the employee experience, and particularly as it relates to neurodiversity, which is a hugely important topic. Thank you for tuning in today and enjoy the conversation. All right, Dave, welcome to the Leaderful Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm deeply honored. Thank you so much for having me, man. Great to see you.
Yeah, great to see you as well. What are you most excited about these days? What's on your plate?
It's been kind of an upward trajectory for me, and I just get more and more stoked as time goes on. So I hate to say it's nothing new, but you know, I've been part of this kind of movement within the world of work for the past many years, really about 10 years, about starting with the brain and creating a more inclusive place to work for people who think a little bit differently, people like me and many others. And just more and more has been happening in that space as time's gone on. And it's kind of the multiplier effect. Like, it just keeps on getting much, much more exciting. Right. So, people talk about the Sunday scaries and, you know, dragging on Mondays. It's the opposite for me. Like, I'm not a sporting kind of person, but I feel like it's before a big game on a Sunday. Like, I'm just so excited to be part of this stuff. And it's my special interest, my passion. So, awesome. Everything.
Awesome. Well, we're going to dig into what that looks like. But maybe let's start there at the Sunday scaries and the world of work. And, you know, we talk a lot here about psychological safety and some of those other pieces of the workplace that, you know, especially right now, the news headlines are dominated by layoffs in at least the tech industry. But, you know, there's a lot of concern, I think, and a lot of people experiencing the workplace as not a particularly safe environment for a lot of folks. And I know you've alluded to it, but for folks, you know, with some neurodivergence or not, I don't like find the right language for that. I'm being told on a regular basis whether it's neurodivergent or not. They're like, what that is. And so I'd love your take on that. But your work is often in that space of how do we make workplaces friendlier for people, like you said, whose brains work differently, right? And are neurodivergent. So do you want to start there? Do we want to start at the state of safety in the workplace and what you're seeing, particularly from the folks you work with?
Sure. And if you know, and if you don't mind, we can get to know me better by kind of starting with me, right? So yeah. I was diagnosed at 5 with ADHD and dyslexia, and I kind of felt growing up like I was raised based on some assumed inabilities on my part, assumed impairments, and you know, these terms like learning disability, right? And I think that was very limiting to me and my growth. Whereas you see me now, and I'm going to be 37, and I'm doing really well. Like, I'm a high performing person. I'm a busy professional who has a lot of exciting things going on, and I've done a TEDx like you, and you know. So what happened, right? And a lot of what happened is the neurodiversity movement. So I'll define that too. You know, we're getting a lot done here. So the neurodiversity movement would be like a strengths-based approach to the human brain, right? So not necessarily medicalizing or pathologizing the naturally occurring differences in the brain. And that kind of switch for me happened when I struggled through school, got out, and decided to be the person when I needed when I was younger. I know that that's a kind of a cliche, but that's where I was at. And I got a lot out of working in human services, a lot, I think, like your story, right? And in doing so, became a job coach for mostly autistic young adults who needed the world of work to look a little bit different. And when I was empowered to understand some of the already established best practices of what to, you know, how to set these people up for success, use those on me, and also explore and innovate, because it was a, such a new space, explore and innovate and figure out what worked best for them and for me, I started to really hit my stride and get excited, not just about the movement itself, because it's the right thing to do and the smart thing to do, but because it was working and working on me. Right. Mm-hmm. So still, even after that, it took me till about 2019 to start talking about my brain at work, which is kind of funny. Right. But I don't think people who were at least raised in my generation were raised in a way that you're super honest about your vulnerabilities in that way. And the even in a pretty safe environment. But for the most part, you know, as you know, the workplace is not as person-centered and kind and flexible and empathetic and understanding as it could be, right? Mm-hmm. So we got a lot of work to do, but the past couple of years in this space have been really, really exciting as far as making sure companies and employers are walking the walk, and that it's not on us, the neurodivergent kind of individuals, to do the work, right?
Is that a piece of the crux of it? Is that the flexibility and ability of employers and leaders to be flexible and adaptive to the individual needs of people coming in, and they putting the responsibility on them to adapt? Like, is that essentially the crux of it, or what do you see as some of the biggest barriers, I guess, to inside the workplace for us to get this done better and faster?
I think a lot of it is a rebranding of, you know, not just that word neurodiversity is an incredibly empowering thing for the individual, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also empowering for everyone, for the employer. First of all, so you said neurodivergent, neurodiverse, right? Like, so let's go over that. Neurodiversity is something that we all are, no matter what your neurotype. Like, so that can be used in a sentence the same way diverse or diversity can. So a person can't be diverse. You can only have a group that's diverse, right? A person can be divergent. So in a room of neurotypical people, if I walk in, I'm diverging away and therefore neurodivergent, right? But the human fabric, we as human brains all coming together, we're a neurodiverse group, and that's a wonderful thing. So first of all, a huge barrier we need to get over is the understanding that neurodiversity already exists. It's existed since the beginning of time, and that as long as your company is employing more than a few people, you have neurodivergent people on staff. So I love telling big employers, congratulations on your neurodiversity hiring, you know, like, so making peace with the fact that this is not just now proactive neurodiversity hiring initiatives. That is very much part of my world. I think it's a wonderful thing and it's important, but that is not where you need to start from at a company of 10,000 people. What about supporting the people that are already within your company, right? And also, in this kind of rebrand, when you start with the human brain and you start with people that, you know, may be set up for success in a highly unique way and creating that amount of flexibility within the world of work, you're really elevating everybody. So when I'm training managers and employers internationally on some best practices of what will really, really help folks like me and, you know, my autistic friends, my friends with PTSD, OCD, etc., if they come work for their company, the biggest thing I get back is, this is great for every, like, I wish we already had this. And we say, yeah, it's not that big of a favor. It's not that big of a lift. It's really just a better workplace for everybody. So A, you're empowering more of your team through empowering neurodivergent people, but B, this is just great stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. I think we see that kind of across the board when you look at safety and you look at the factors that drive that, or you look at people's ability to contribute meaningfully to the workplace or to the conversation, anything we can do to unlock that is good across the board for everyone. What do you see as some of the, I guess, the biggest barriers or the biggest And these could be like strategic level barriers that exist, or they could be quite tactical things that exist. But what do you see? Maybe there's some quick wins for the listener. Somebody's listening and they need a little roadmap. So they're listening to Jeff and Dave talk about this, and they go back into their workplace and they start looking around. Where do you see some of the most, the lowest hanging fruit, if there is any? And I'm sure there is some, but.
I have two answers. One is more large, and it's within, let's say you are the person responsible for really like creating, you're a huge decision maker, you're creating job opportunities. A lot of the rigidities within the world of work are for somewhat good reason, right? Like we all use Windows, but someone comes in and wants to use Linux. Like, that's a little bit complicated, right? But a lot of them aren't. A lot of, for example, job descriptions. You look at a job description for someone, an entry level cybersecurity position, and it says must be an excellent communicator. What is that? A, what does that mean? And B, why? Right. So does that mean they're going to be giving TED talks? No. Like, so does it mean responsive by email? Be more specific.
Yeah.
And don't let so many people be self-selecting out. Like, that's what I would do as a young professional, right? So just being, you know, that's a very specific example of like a rigid, you know, process or piece of the world of work, right? But just,
it's helpful though, because that's, sorry to cut you off, but yeah. I think that level of specificity is really important, because people have, you know, we talk about the intention impact gap. It's not because we have bad intentions that our job descriptions are so poorly designed or poorly worded or too vague. It's not through lack of intention. It's just like, oh, somebody built that several years ago and they have a little boxes of different competencies that they copy and paste into their job descriptions. And that was just HR taking a shortcut however many years ago. And now hiring managers are putting their job descriptions together and they're going back to these buckets, and maybe they're not empowered to think critically about what does that actually mean? And is that specific enough for this role? And does this role actually need it? So although you say it's a small example, that level of specificity is really important, because those are the points that we experience, right? That's somebody's on the other end of that job description reading it, or that advertisement, right? And they're, like you said, they're either selecting in or selecting out. And I think a lot of the times we don't take enough we're not intentional enough with stuff like that.
And to your point, I would never question the intent. I don't think that people are deliberately excluding anyone from the world of work, right? I think that people have the best intentions, and I think that there's reasons for stuff, and there's reasons for copy paste, and there's reasons for save as, and there's reasons for the last person that had this position did it and I didn't know if that was from the legal department or not, so I just left it in, you know, like there's reasons why these things happen. And I guess that it is good to go into such a specific example, but to zoom out, you know, it's like, look at your culture, look at your processes, and ask yourself why, and ask yourself, is this enough? Are we providing enough context? Are we providing enough flexibility? We always say, you know, be flexible, be very communicative with your what expectations are and your why, like the mission, vision, and how people fit into it, right? But be as flexible as possible with the when, the where, and the how, when possible. But there's obviously limitations there. Something else you reminded me of is my boss, Jeff Miller. He's the CEO of Potentia, an incredible leader and thinker with many years of experience in the staffing and recruiting industry, and has a neurodivergent son, and so went into this, you know, kind of left the corner office for this mission-driven work a couple of years ago. But what he always says is, learn the lessons, lose the label. So what that means is, who cares if it's because I have ADHD? I don't need to show my ADHD card because I need noise canceling headphones in the workplace, right? So on kind of a less a less tactical level or less logistical level, what I like to tell managers and employers, people that say, hey, I think my colleague is autistic, right? What I like to say is, don't make it weird. Like, what do you think that they need? Or take a help me help you approach. Ask them what they need. Like, learn the lessons, lose the labels. It doesn't matter. We should be fixing the world of work to the point where it doesn't matter what people have or why. It could be because you have, you know, you forgot that your kids are off school today, or you haven't announced that you're going to be out on maternity leave soon, or, you know, this reminds you of something a little bit triggering from your past, or you do have undiagnosed or diagnosed ADHD, autism, etc. Like, all of those things just need a little bit more flexibility, empathy, understanding, and some of these kind of success enablers that that we talk about at Potentia.
Yeah, no, I love that. And that aligns well. I cut my teeth in addiction and mental health treatment early in my career, and the label itself was often the barrier. It was often the thing that got in the way, because it became self-fulfilling prophecies in some ways. And it became, you know, we lose the person behind the label, and it's like, oh, they have autism. I can imagine, you know, oh, so we have to do X, right? It becomes a one size fits all approach as opposed to a one size fits one, right? We're already trying to dismantle that one size fits all, generally speaking, but I would see it happen, you know, if depression, insert X treatment, or if anxiety, or if addiction, you do this. And I think we probably want to avoid that type of prescriptive, like, approach, it knowing that there's some best practices in there too. So, you know, I was always wrestling with, you know, the label can be helpful in getting us onto the same page or into the same territory of what might be helpful, but we have to be able to figure out what's meaningful for Dave, right? What does Dave actually find helpful, and can we meet those needs and help, or like you said, take that help me help you type approach.
Yeah, for sure. It's really interesting to hear that in a different context, because we talk a lot about how all this stuff works for, you know, mental health, and that it's very similar, and veterans, which are often put in a, you know, there's so much intersectionality, first of all, between all of these groups, but are often put in like a disability bucket automatically, or a neurodivergent bucket automatically, because of PTSD and because of things, you know, other stuff that they come home with, right? So it's interesting to hear from a substance, you know, standpoint.
And how do you navigate, or how do you help employers navigate that intersectionality? Because sometimes I think, and I'm probably guilty of this in the past, is that narrow divergence inside of a group can look like personality, and then can be individualized as like, oh, Jeff just doesn't get along with people, or Jeff's an a-hole, or Jeff's a whatever, right? Like, we don't use the formal labels. We kind of go around and we get these shorthand personality descriptors. And I know I've wrestled with that in the past with talking through employers. Again, it goes back to that, what do you know about this person's perspective from their perspective? And it's usually nothing. So that's usually a starting point. But how do you help people, I guess, dismantle some of that, like, personality versus neurodiversity perspective? Is that a thing even that you run into? Or
yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, first of all, you have to it's kind of like the job description thing, right? It's like, let's define what it means to be a team player. Okay, well, at my job in New York City, what it meant to really feel like part of the group or be considered part of the group was if you went to happy hour after work, but I didn't drink. So was I may have been seen like I wasn't part of the group, but it was because I had to get home and take care of somebody vulnerable, right? Like, and they didn't need to know that, but then I felt ostracized or something like that, right? So, you know, what's our definition of being rigid or difficult, or what's our definition of being a friendly or a team player? And let's cater people's, you know, this is an ideal, and but let's start from here, right? Let's cater people's jobs to what they want to do. So much of supporting like autistic young adults is like, they need to make friends. They need to make friends. What if that's not their definition of a meaningful life or a meaningful work experience? What if they don't want happy birthday sung to them? And does that mean that they're not worthy of work or valuable to their employer? Absolutely not. So, like, I know, you know, people who the word nonverbal in the autism community is thrown around a lot, but there's a lot of people who don't necessarily elect to speak or to have conversations. They're verbal. They can speak, but they don't. Like, they don't tend to want to chat and have those kind of contrived small talk conversations that other people do. And some of those people are maybe 300, 400 times more productive than their colleagues, and it's not because like it, and they like it and they're happy to do it. And so just because they didn't want to come to the pizza party or have happy birthday sung to them doesn't mean that they're not super valuable to their employer and not appreciated and valued by everybody else. So I think it's complicated for sure. One, I can tell you one kind of tool that we use is we like to make sure that people understand that when we're talking about things like belonging and psychological safety at work, that it's in order to be able to do stuff like this, right? Like to have conversations and say, hey, Jeff, like what, how do you like to feel appreciated? Or what's your preferred method of communication? Or how do I know if you're struggling, how do I know and what should I do? Like, you know, and again, not simple, not easy, but if you're nurturing and managing a culture of true belonging and psychological safety, that is an incredibly empowering thing to be asked, any of those things. It's cool on a self-reflective standpoint because maybe you've never thought about it before or been invited to memorialize that anywhere before. That's what happened for me. And B, if your boss and your colleagues actually accommodate those things, imagine the difference between that and whatever your last job was. I mean, that's super cool, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. The bar is actually quite low for psychological safety, I think. And so it doesn't actually take much for most managers or employers to create some space for people to, like you say, get at least their needs on the table. I think one of the things that a lot of leaders struggle with, or a lot of teams struggle with, is if you don't have that baseline of safety, which is really built inside of the power dynamics. So we spend a lot of time talking about power at the Allied Co., particularly the right use of power. It's a framework, a model we use to better understand dynamics, like human dynamics. And I think what ends up happening, so maybe I'll describe the first three types of power. And there's five different types, but these three types, I'd love to get your take on maybe that power as the intersectional piece here that we're actually talking about, because there's, you know, I guess the seat of power, the core of power, is this idea of personal power, right? And so Jeff and Dave, we have personal power. We got ourselves to the mics today. We probably got ourselves fed and dressed, and you know, we got ourselves here. We affected change based on our drive and our motivation, our health, our wellness, the skills and competencies that we've accumulated over the years, are they're here in the room with us, right? So that's personal power. All of us have it. You know, I've got three small kids. They're 6, 8, and 11. The 6-year-old doesn't have as much personal power as the 11-year-old because he doesn't have the same life experience and hasn't built the same skill set and those things. But, you know, we all have some element of personal power. Mm-hmm. We have role power. Right? And so when we get into an organization or onto a team, we suddenly have that you mentioned the job description. And with that job description comes a certain amount of power that we can then use to affect change for other people or for the company, for clients, whatever that looks like. And then we have this idea of status power. And status power are the memberships that we hold, right? And so as a cisgendered, white, heterosexual man, I belong to certain clubs in society that have power, more power than others do. And so when I think about intersectionality, I think about power dynamics coming to play. And I think that, you know, what ends up happening for a lot of folks is that the personal power, which we often think of as like just personality, rubs up against the role power, right? And starts to either there's a tension there sometimes that exists, or there's a nice congruence where it's like, oh, I'm in a role, like you said, that really meets my personal power, right? So my neurodivergence is a type of personal power, right? Ability to focus differently or think differently, or, you know, whatever that looks like. And it's a mismatch often with these roles that are often rooted in like the expectations of somebody who would be more, I don't want to use the words typical, but neurotypical or neuro, whatever the like a monolithic, like whoever the guys like me, right? Mm-hmm. Those white cisgendered men who find our way into power positions, and then we set the expectations from there. So that's a bit of a soliloquy, like that's a long-winded paragraph that I just gave you with no real question in it, other than when you think about power in the workplace, from the perspective and from your observations of people trying to navigate that, what does that look like? Or how does that show up? How has that showed up for you in the past, trying to leverage your personal power to get change met in the workplace and those types of things?
I can tell you, as someone who is also, you know, white, male, cisgendered, I was never comfortable around that type of authority figure, people that were like my dad, you know, like, I never really knew why. And I always felt like an other, and I never really associated that necessarily too much with the way my brain worked, right? But I identified with the others, and I became a punk rocker, and I think that that's a wonderful thing. That was where I found solace. You know, I was never comfortable around that kind of. I was a sociology major, and in there you'd call it ascribed versus achieved status, right? So ascribed is just the things that you have when you walk in the room, and you didn't necessarily earn them, but they're different than other people's, and you can be born into like ascribed status. Whereas achieved would be something like a harvard.edu email address is like it, that carries something with it. Even if you're just making a dentist's appointment, if you're making it with a harvard.edu, I think that people like you and me, first of all, and present like you and me, need to be very aware of the kind of the way they're carrying themselves. Mm-hmm. And I have self-selected out of so many conversations, employment opportunities, even especially extracurriculars as a kid and things like that, just because I was intimidated by the kind of person or what I assumed to be the kind of person running something or in charge of something, you know, doctors, cops, lawyers, authority figures of any kind. So I make sure to be extremely I hope that, you know, how I'm perceived is extremely accessible and vulnerable. And I think that the biggest thing that I ever did for myself as a leader was to show a ton of vulnerability in the first 5 minutes of meeting people, of making sure not only that people know that I'm neurodivergent, not that like, oh, here's my other card, you know, like not like that necessarily, but just that I don't have all the answers. I'm eager to do what you need me to do to set you up for success. This is a mutually beneficial kind of transactional relationship where, you know, I want to serve you, right? Those kinds of ideas have been really important to me in how I position myself, and that has been very empowering to me personally. I think people need to be very aware of the kind of time and space they take up. So I ramble. And so I have written on my desk time and space, because I need to make sure I'm literally giving people time and space to speak. Same with physical space. I'm a huge guy with tattoos all over my arms. And I was told once that I looked like a bouncer at a club that was going to like kick somebody out because I was crossing my arms in a doorway. And I realized that as an authority figure within a company, this is back when I was, you know, working outside of my house, you know, as an authority figure within a company, me just standing like that, if someone had never spoken to me before, it was someone's first day, like that would be something that would horrify me when I was entering the world of work, right? So just be aware of the kind of vibe, I guess, that you're putting out, whether that's physical, verbal, you know, be purposeful in your leadership style. I think that that's, I know that's a very general way to cap it off, but that's what I mean.
No, and I asked you a general question, and so I appreciate that response, because it's, I think about the, so there's power, and then there's the power dynamic that exists from a leader to the people that they're there to support, and you're alluding to some of that, and the awareness of who has the up in the up power position, whether you're a father or a boss or whatever the role is, being aware of that, the impact that just the power dynamic has alone, without you doing anything or saying anything, right? Standing cross-armed in the doorway has a potential impact. One thing that comes from the research around power and, you know, my own lived experience with power, and I'm sure yours as well, but I shouldn't assume, I'm assuming yours, but we'll dig into it, is that when you're on the down power side, right? So when you have less power in a context, whether that's on a team or in a relationship, you're much more sensitive to the power dynamic. Mm-hmm. Right? And so is it fair to say that from your experience, people with some level of neurodivergence in a group, are they going to be the ones most sensitive or more sensitive potentially to power dynamics that other people can't necessarily see in the same way?
For sure. And yeah. I think that that's for two major reasons. I'm very careful to say, you know, I only represent me and my own brain, but I have worked with and supported and studied, you know, tons of people and differences, etc. Dr. Stephen Shore, who's an autistic professor from my hometown on Long Island, New York, famously said, "If you know one person with autism, great, you know one person with autism." So I and same goes for, you know, neurodiversity generally. So I want to be careful, but I will say that either because of our neurotypes or because of what we've had to do to organize things in our head, like I'm not a very natural, my mind's not like a steel trap, but I might write everything down and study an organizational chart, right? Or my autistic friend Josh will have memorized that organizational chart, and if something changes without you updating the organizational chart in the handbook or whatever, he'll know and he'll notice and he'll say, "Wait, that doesn't make sense. This person's asking me for this, but they're just this role," right? Like, so there's that neurodivergent people tend to pay attention to not just hierarchy, but they organize things in literally a different way. As a dyslexic person, I see things backwards, upside down, inside out, and I think that's to my benefit, right? So there's that. There's just being aware that people interpret things differently or treat documents with a different level of seriousness or literalness than you might, right? There's that. But then there's also just the history we're up against. I mean, we've been part of a society of exclusion for a long time. And then, sure, segregation, which is not as good, right? That's you go to a different school than your sister. At least you go to school, but it's different. Then there's integration, which is more of the environment that I grew up in, which is, sure, you get to go to the same school as your sister, but you're not going to be in the same class, right? And workplaces like that too. In the U.S., we have something called sheltered workshops, which were like below minimum wage positions, making license plates and things like that. A lot of the things that prisoners do, people like who are neurodivergent or disabled people have done historically. That's not okay either. And then now we have this big, great, sexy word, inclusion. But what does it really mean? And so it's people are very quick, when included, to feel like it's either for the wrong reasons or, again, I used that word earlier, but self-selecting out for one reason or another. And yeah, I'm going to be looking for a reason. You know what I mean? Not me anymore, but me 15 years ago? Absolutely. Yeah.
And I can only imagine that that's a self-protective mechanism, right? It's to avoid getting into places where you're not safe. Right, because of the way that you think and the way that you're different. I mean, that it's interesting that safety word, like even just the word psychological safety, it's become a buzzword. It's become one of those things, and I think it's an important buzzword, but I also see it misapplied often around what it actually means. And so I don't know if you have a favorite framework around psychological safety. We lean on Dr. Timothy Clark's work around the four stages of psychological safety. But
yeah, I really enjoy the four stages. I mean, what I usually do when I go through that with a group is I, not without starting with the four stages, I ask them four questions. I say, take me back to your first job or your worst job. Think about one of those in your head. And then did you always feel like you were part of the team? You know, from the top to bottom, did you feel like you could make mistakes, that you could ask questions, that you could seek extra help? Did you feel like your contributions went anywhere? Were you credited properly? Were they taken seriously, et cetera? And of course, for neurodivergent people in particular, very important, challenger safety, which is the very hard one to swallow for a lot of people. Because, but we use Windows, he wants to use Linux. Yes. We understand that it's not all possible, but again, time and space, written on my desk, it is very important that we're curating times and spaces where conversations are happening and people feel okay saying, well, I see it a different way. And what's interesting about neurodiversity hiring initiatives, you know, proactive neurodiversity hiring initiatives, is they see immediate return on investment for creating that level of psychological safety. Ernst & Young was one of the kind of the forefathers of creating these neurodiversity hiring initiatives. They have something called the Neurodiverse Center of Excellence. And in their first cohort of new hires a number of years ago, they said in the onboarding training, please let us know what we could do better. Feel free to pick us apart and blah, blah, blah. And someone raised their hand. And because of that, I don't have the exact number, but hundreds of millions of dollars were saved. They permanently changed their onboarding and training process because of this person's feedback.
Wow.
So we really, really want to cultivate spaces where it's okay to ask why.
Mm-hmm. I love that story. I'll have to dig into it. We'll find an article or the I'll anecdote or something. Article. You'll send me the article and we'll post it for the listener. I usually don't spend a ton of time with clients talking about the ROI in the form mm-hmm. of dollars and cents. I mean, it's important. I get it. But the human side of the relationships and the experience that people are having in your workplace and the innovation that you want to drive for your customer, for your client. Challenger safety is absolutely the missing ingredient, I think, in a lot of teams. And we measure that. Like, we've got some surveys that we do on different indicators of workplace culture. And one of them is psychological safety. And reliably speaking, challenger safety is the lowest every time. Across the board. I think it's hard in general for us, and we're up here in Canada, and so some of that is our general too polite or politeness gene that we all share. But I think in the workplace, there's lots of reasons why people wouldn't speak up, right? For a variety of reasons, and especially if the workplace and the culture is not as accommodating and as inclusive as, of different perspectives as we actually need it to be. So you mentioned hiring initiatives and supporting employers. I know that's a lot of the work that you do is in supporting employers with being successful with increasing neurodiversity on the team and making that space more available. You mentioned we got really tactical with the job description, just being a little bit more clear about that. But if we zoom out a little bit to what are some initiatives that you're helping people explore these days?
Yeah, sure. So Potential Workforce is a company that in short supports leading organizations through programs, products, projects in becoming more neuroinclusive. How we do that primarily historically has been through our STARS initiative. STARS is a three-step process where we partner with an organization. So for example, we've done a number of pilots with Chevron internationally. And working in the United States, Buenos Aires, and Manila currently with Chevron. And so what we do is the company identifies a certain department or team that they want to have an initiative within, and we train those actual managers in, you know, transforming their department to make it more inclusive of neurodivergent people. We don't want to just let companies check off a box and say, sure, we'll take some neurodivergent hires, right? We really are providing a much higher level. And the more important thing to me is these best practices and supporting them through, inclusive leadership training, things like psychological safety, things like success enablers, which is our, you know, kind of fancy rebrand of the word accommodations. We want to normalize what it takes to be successful in the workplace, whether it's something small like me using a stress ball all the time and noise-canceling headphones and LED lights, or whether it's something that you actually have to go through the accommodations process with. So, and then also, a circle of support that's formal with mentors and buddies and things like that. So that's the first step. The second step is that we actually recruit neurodivergent talent for specialized roles within the organization. Our average starting salary for these positions is $81,000. So it's usually highly specialized, often tech roles, but all different kinds of roles. And then the last step in that STARS process is support. We provide ongoing support to not just that new hire, but to their managers, mentors, et cetera. And to be clear, when we say we have talent coaches on staff, a lot of the time my old colleagues from when I worked in human services would say, oh, I'm a job coach. I support autistic young adults in a workplace or whatever. What people don't realize is that our talent coaches are giving at least just as much feedback to the managers and the circles of support than we are to these new hires. Because what I tell neurodivergent people every chance I get is the world of work needs to catch up to us. They have more work to do than we do. And that's very much true on a practical level. So that's STARS. We're also launching a program called Empower. So if a large organization said, but we're not we're in a hiring freeze right now with the economy the way it is. That said, we have an answer for that. You already have a ton of neurodivergent people within your workforce. So Empower Advisory Services looks at metrics like employee engagement, productivity, retention, and looks at where you're at as far as neuroinclusivity and as far as your interactions with your employees, from recruiting all the way to career pathing and retention, starting with the brain, right? Mm-hmm. ERGs, everything. A really kind of soup to nuts approach for divisions within large organizations. So that's very, very exciting. We'll have more on that soon, and we're going to be launching our first pilot shortly for Empower.
Yeah, I love the breadth of what it sounds like you, how you approach it, and to use the word checkbox, like we're not here to check a box. And that's something I hear myself saying to leaders all the time. It's like, if you want a box checking, then we're not the right fit for you, because if we want to create meaningful change and sustainable change, we have to talk about the context that people are working in, and that's their managers and their leaders and the support network around them. And so I love that approach of not, I think too often we individualize these things and we say, well, let's get Dave a coach and he'll help. And yes, maybe that's important. There are some skills that we can all grow in that way. But what are we doing about the manager that is taking the one size fits all approach, or hasn't revisited whatever job descriptions or performance reviews or the things that are getting in the way? So I love the breadth of that. And yeah, exciting to hear the work you guys are doing.
Right. And again, it's about not just a rebrand, but a convincing, a selling people on the fact that this is in that manager's best interest to diversify the way that they're approaching their staff. And you know, we never really get, I regret learning these, you know, best practices. You know what I mean? Yeah. They really are, this kind of support and workplace transformation really does benefit everyone, including those managers.
Yeah. Advice for the listener, if they want to learn more about the work, I mean, we'll have links to Potentia and I'll have links to your LinkedIn, probably is a good place to direct people. I know you've started a group actually recently in the last couple months around supporting people with ADHD in the workplace. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I'm sure we've got some listeners that would love to check it out.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, most of my work historically has been about either autism specifically, where I spent many years at a mission-first social enterprise that has the mission of employing young adults who are autistic. And so it wasn't really necessarily about me and my brain. And then kind of broadening out to neurodiversity more broadly, I've never kind of zoomed in on myself and talked about that. I've never really been an ADHD coach or anything like that. And the world of finding support for ADHD is just very, coaches and that stuff is important, but it's fairly covered in people selling stuff, right? So I decided to start a community around just exploring, supporting, and celebrating, frankly, the things that make us different at work for professionals with ADHD. It's going really well, and really exciting thing to be a part of. See where it goes, and. You know, speaking of what people can do and kind of a call to action, of course, we support mostly large companies, some smaller ones as well in walking the walk. But we don't seek to make a dime off neurodivergent people, but we support them as well, right? So we do recruit and provide best practices and things like that to neurodivergent professionals. And if you go on our careers page, you can join what's called our neurodiverse talent community, and join our monthly call and get some email newsletters and things like that. And there's plenty more to come for our neurodiverse talent community, or NDTC. Very, very exciting. Because, you know, again, it's not a favor to include us, right? And I think that you agree, Jeff, right? I mean, it's been good to have me on, right?
Yeah, no, it's been wonderful. I learned something new, and it's been great. It's interesting that neurodiversity like you said, you know, we're probably about the same age. I just turned 40. And so we're in that same demographic where, you know, ADHD, and I think still to some extent, it's been very pathologized. You know, it's been a disorder. It's been that language, that medicalized kind of language has followed a lot of that into for the past few decades. And I don't see it. Maybe it's unlocking a little bit, but it needs to be fully disrupted, because the disordered anything, I think, when it comes to mental health or neurodiversity, just doesn't match the reality of what people bring to the world and mm-hmm. to their relationships and to the workplace and all the places that people go to. So conversations like this, I think, are helpful for me, because there's still that, you know, we carry that programming around with us. And I'm sure that you have moments where you look at it and you're like, no, this isn't, you know, this is not the thing that I was told it was when I was a kid going through school or whatever. So I appreciate your openness and your honesty and your willingness to jump into these conversations a lot. So
I appreciate your show very much. You're doing really, really incredible work. So thank you.
Well, thanks for joining me. And we'll definitely have people check you out on the various places on the internet. And maybe we'll do a round two sometime, because we probably just scratched the surface with what we can't talk about.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Dave.
Leaderful is brought to you by The Ally Co., a team of human-centered, systems-conscious consultants, coaches, and facilitators dedicated to helping you and your team tackle the core problems of burnout and stuckness and misalignment and misuses of power and all of the things that get in the way of creating truly human-centered workplaces where everyone thrives and does their best work. Head over to www.theallyco.world to learn more.